On the program today, a smattering of Greece, a soupçon of trade gap analysis, and Colonel Sanders is back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, the 7th of July. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Item one, Greece, Athens, and Eurozone officials are still talking. That's about the latest update we've got. Item two, Greece. We still know exactly two of the hundreds of things that are going to happen between now and whenever this thing gets solved. That is, Greece is either in the euro or it's not. And item three, with all of that said, listen, how about some trade deficit news, huh? Figures out this morning showed the U.S. trade deficit got slightly bigger in May. We now have an almost $42 billion gap between the value of the goods and services that we import over the value of the stuff that we export. Some economists will tell you this is a bad thing. Others will say it's perfectly normal. We will say that this flow of things in and out of our economy can tell us some interesting things about said economy. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is going to do just that.
Americans tend to buy more from foreigners than they do from us. It's long been that way. So how does the trade deficit tell us the story of the global economy? Well, we can look at how it changes, whether the deficit is growing or shrinking. And in recent months, it's been growing slightly. Why?
First of all, the U.S. dollar has been stronger against foreign currencies recently, and that puts a brake on U.S. exports.
Douglas Irwin is an econ professor at Dartmouth, and he says reason number two, exports are struggling.
Foreign economic growth has been weak, and there's still a lot of problems in Europe.
Greece, anyone?
So that has put a damper on exports as well.
The value of imports dropped a little in May, too, but not as much as exports, and some of that may be tied up in falling oil prices. But in general, lots of imports, it's actually a sign of a strong U.S. economy, counterintuitive as that may seem, says Dan Eikenson. He's director of the Cato Institute's Center for Trade Policy Studies.
Because consumers have more money to spend and businesses expand production.
Contrast that to the recession years, where growth, especially in emerging economies, held on while the U.S. slowed, says Robert Lawrence, a professor of international trade and investment at Harvard.
So we were able to maintain some of our sales to the rest of the world. In effect, that kept our economy slightly stronger than it would otherwise have been.
So he says, in a sense,
we're back to a pattern where we support them. Our growth stimulates and sort of stabilizes them rather than the reverse.
Exports will always be an important slice of our economic pie. But Lawrence says for us to keep chugging with our recovery, lots more demand will have to come from here at home rather than abroad. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Okay, moving on. Item four, Greece. Again, we and dozens of other media enterprises, both here and abroad, have spent no small amount of time reporting on the slow-motion disaster that is the Greek debt crisis. And it really is, in all honesty, a disaster. GDP there is down by a quarter in the past 7 years. That's a nearly unprecedented decline for a developed country in peacetime. Unemployment there is above 25% of the workforce. But still, and again, just because this thing will eventually get solved and we don't know what's going to happen between now and then, what do you suppose are the potential bright spots in a functioning Greek economy? Marketplace's Adam Allington has that story.
Way back before this whole mess started between Greece and the European Central Bank, back before the high unemployment, budget cuts, and austerity negotiations, Greece was on the upswing. Harvard economist Ken Rogoff.
They were a good emerging market with lots of strengths.
Those strengths were a booming tourism industry. Greece has some of the most beautiful coastal resorts in Europe. There's also that little structure called the Parthenon. Those assets, notes Rogoff, are still there.
Well, tourism surely is eventually going to be a bright spot because at some point the price of the currency and costs are going to collapse.
Going forward, says Rogoff, Greece could take better advantage of its assets if it could devalue its currency, thus becoming more competitive to other countries.
They could bail themselves out more easily if they weren't on the euro right now. There's no doubt about that.
Unfortunately for Greece, tourism is primarily a summer industry. Northwestern University economist George Georgiadis says the country's biggest asset might be all of its unemployed doctors, engineers, lawyers, and other highly educated workers.
So if Greece were to provide the right conditions for international companies to invest, they would be able to tap into a highly educated population.
Georgiadis points out that in addition to devaluing its currency, Greece still needs to address a host of other issues that are bad for business, things like corruption and tax evasion.
Otherwise, it's just going to hurt the economy because the buying power of Greeks would collapse.
Georgiadis says when and if Greece does exit the euro, it won't be able to wait long to implement reforms, or it will risk losing the job skills that are currently languishing in its underemployed workforce. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
One last Greek thing, and then we'll move on, I promise. We really will. Late this afternoon, Dutch Finance Minister Jorn Dijsselbloem, he is the president of the Eurogroup. That's basically all the finance ministers of all the countries that use the euro, the single currency. Dijsselbloem issued a statement saying he had met with the new Greek finance minister. They had a nice chat, apparently. No new proposals on the table, however. Maybe a new one tomorrow, he said. And, quote, "We have very little time, as you are all aware," end of quote. And now you know. On Wall Street today, well, honestly, it could have been really ugly. The Dow was off a couple of hundred points around lunchtime. Arguably, though, the more important index right now, Shanghai, off more than 1% overnight. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If there's one thing the tech sector loves, boy, it's a good get-together. You can call them meetups or hackathons, expos or geek fests if you so choose. They are getting to be more popular than ever. In fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says events and conventions overall are one of the fastest-growing sectors of the American economy. But as Marketplace's Molly Wood reports, the tech conference industry is a little bit like the tech industry itself. A little bubbly, perhaps.
Hello, and welcome to Open Air 2015.
These days, it seems like everybody is throwing themselves a conference.
Please join me in welcoming to the stage Airbnb co-founder and CEO, Brian Chesky.
That's the sound of 800 people who paid $50 each to hear Airbnb's CEO, Brian Chesky, and other tech heavyweights talk about search and data technology. Alex Maurice, a data scientist at a big consulting firm, was part of the crowd in San Francisco.
For me, it's just to hear about who's doing what type of methods they're using, and just to keep current with colleagues and friends.
Maurice said he's expected to go to 3 to 5 conferences a year for work. His big challenge is narrowing down the options. TechMeme, a tech news website, lists 97 tech conferences between now and December. Things like Coin Summit, Reboot SF, and Growth Beat.
Oh, they're missing a bunch if they only have 97, because I'm sure there's at least 5 or 6 a day.
Tonya Reese is a PR executive who ran a marketing and events firm for 13 years. She's put on a lot of conferences.
Face-to-face continues to be the most powerful and high-impact way for people to connect with each other, to build new relationships and to deepen existing relationships.
Most of the new tech conferences are small, maybe a day or two, and they're focused on specific topics like virtual reality or entrepreneurship. A small event can give young companies a chance to market themselves and show off their tech, and they don't require a lot of money up front.
The new conference types that I've really enjoyed, though, are mini conferences like this, where they're just a day.
That's Lauren Mosenthal, the founder of a women's mentorship community called Glassbreakers. She was at the Airbnb conference in San Francisco. But while small conferences might be the trend, bigger players like TechCrunch or VentureBeat have the clout to pull in well-known panelists, A-list media, and higher-octane audiences. And that gives them a chance at a bigger payoff, said Tonya Reese.
Not only in terms of the attendee fees and the marketing dollars that they can capture from sponsorships and exhibits, but also ultimately in terms of the impact to themselves as a media brand.
For everybody in the conference game, the competition is getting tougher. There are only so many panelists, so many topics, and for the people expected to fill all those conference seats, so many days in a week. Again, Lauren Mosenthal.
It could be easy for entrepreneurs to get lost into going to conferences and networking instead of focusing on their product and how to make that better.
Just so happens, there's a time management conference for that. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
I saw an ad on TV the other day that made me do a little bit of a double take. Colonel Sanders. Yes, Colonel Sanders from Kentucky Fried Chicken, back on screen selling KFC. It struck me because, A, Harlan Sanders died 35 years ago, but also because, B, when was the last time you saw a KFC ad on television anyway? Well, it turns out I'm not the only one who noticed. Vanessa Wong wrote about KFC's time in the wilderness and the company's hope for comeback for BuzzFeed News. Vanessa, it's great to have you back.
Great to be here. Thanks, Kai.
What happened to KFC, man?
So KFC has had a pretty bad few years. They've been closing stores steadily since around 2005, and they're down by about 1,100 stores since then. They have about 4,370 stores now. Meanwhile, competitors like Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, Chick-fil-A. They've lost out to Chick-fil-A.
They've totally lost out to Chick-fil-A. Recently, Chick-fil-A surpassed KFC in terms of sales, even though they have far fewer stores. Like, Chick-fil-A only has 1,900 stores around the country, and they're only open 6 days of the week. So it's pretty remarkable what's happened.
Yum Brands, the parent company, also owner of Pizza Hut and some other stuff. Yum is going to spend $185 million over the next 3 years. They've also enlisted a celebrity spokesperson, if you will. It's a little bit of a blast from the past. We're going to play you some tape. This is Daryl Hammond from Saturday Night Live, and he's in character, as it were. Let's hit that tape.
Howdy, folks. It's me, Colonel Sanders. I've been gone for a while, and boy, howdy, have things changed. Nowadays, you got your International Space Station, your double-sided tape, your car.
All right, so setting aside the weird, is this going to work? They're going back to the original, right?
They're going back. So the Colonel was a staple in their advertising for a long time. The real Colonel Sanders passed away in 1980, and they, you know, this is like a back to the roots campaign. To be honest, I think that Daryl Hammond is charming, and he's got kind of like this loony, enthusiastic character.
he can't. We're gonna play the tail end of this, and it comes off as weird, man. I don't know.
Yeah.
Change that, folks. I'm here to make sure my chicken's still as tasty and delicious as it ever was. I'm Colonel Sanders. And I'm back, America. I'm back, America.
Yeah, so I don't know if people are going to go for that, but whatever. Fast food turnaround is in the news. McDonald's has been trying it, and as you know, and here's the question, though. McDonald's threw itself into a turnaround after only a year of bad news. KFC now is doing it after 10 years of bad news. Where have they been?
Yeah, I mean, to say that their response to this problem is overdue is putting it mildly.
Yeah.
I think particularly at a time now when their Asia business, China specifically, is suffering from food safety issues, it's about time that they start to try to fix things back in the U.S.
Vanessa Wong at BuzzFeed News. Thanks, Vanessa.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up,
I was in my third year of law school, and I'd been drawing as a hobby my whole life, really, and I started posting my drawings on Instagram.
And thus, a career was born. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the markets turned around midday, had a somewhat pleasant afternoon. Thank you very much. The Dow Industrials gained 93 points, 0.5%, 17,776. On the blue chips, the NASDAQ added 5 points, 10%, finished at 49.97. The S&P 500 up 12 points, 0.6%, 2,081. Advanced Micro Devices fell 15% a day after warning sales are declining more than expected. The culprit was as follows: falling PC sales, Intel off 0.4%. Fears of China's stock market, as I mentioned, dragged down commodity prices and shares of Chinese companies traded here in the States. Aluminum Corporation of China off 7.5%. Sinopec Shanghai Petrochemical, a big loser yesterday, off an additional 11% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.25%. You are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue consumer credit data for May. Philadelphia celebrates the anniversary of the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence on July 8, 1776, with a reenactment. And on July 8, 1889, the Wall Street Journal made its debut. Cost of the paper? 2 cents. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The U.S. Trade Representative, a guy by the name of Michael Froman, said today that he is going to do all he can to protect the American sugar industry. He didn't just blab it out, of course. Froman is in the throes of what we are told are end-stage negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade deal the White House has been working on. And apparently, Australia wants more access to the sugar market here, a market that is protected by a pretty sophisticated network of government supports and subsidies. And it's not just international competition at issue either. The Corn Refiners Association has about had it with big sugar as well. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
Corn refiners and the sugar industry have a long-standing rivalry, which has played out in ads like this one.
You don't care what the kids eat, huh?
Excuse me?
That has high fructose corn syrup in it.
Competing claims on this front are at the heart of a legal battle between the two sides. But now, the corn syrup folks are waging a policy battle, too.
The relations are quite poor between the two industries, and we're not going to bite our lip about the policy difference.
John Bodie leads the Corn Refiners Association. Its members include big companies like Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill. The group has hired lobbyists to attack a part of the farm bill known as the sugar program. It provides price floors, limits on sugar imports, and government-backed loans, which sugar producers can repay with sugar if they default. That happened in 2013. Bodie says that cost taxpayers a couple $100 million and the program should end.
It's simply an embarrassment.
That was the one time in the past 10 years that we've seen any cost to U.S. sugar policy.
Philip Hayes is with the American Sugar Alliance. Hayes laments the notion that any ag-related group would take aim at any part of the farm bill, which provides crop insurance premium subsidies to lots of ag sectors.
And that's not just sugar farmers. That's corn farmers. It's soybean farmers. It's all kinds of farmers.
Some ag economists and conservative groups would just as soon scrap the whole farm bill and end all supports. But sugar has a lot of political clout despite its small size, and some say it will be hard for anyone to touch its share. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
It was, as you know if you got stuck in it, a busy holiday weekend on the highways. More drivers, more cops, probably more tickets, too. They're a headache for drivers, those tickets are, but for cities and towns, well, there's a word for what they are. Revenue. Katie Kuntz from Rocky Mountain PBS in Denver reports.
The small town of Campo sits just 8 miles north of the Colorado-Oklahoma border. It's right on the highway, population 107. Dennis Smith has spent most of his life here.
We're losing people all the time. It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
The few businesses that do exist are a hair salon, a gas station, and a small diner. The town collects zero sales tax, but residents still enjoy a public school and a swimming pool. So how do they pay for it all?
Yes, Campo thrives on tickets. Yeah, I mean, it does.
That's Campo police officer Brad Viner. In 2013, tickets generated more than $300,000 here, 93% of the town's total revenue. City officials say that Campo needs that revenue or the town could die. Viner says there's a more important reason.
We have to look at the fact that if a traffic crash does happen, it could be devastating to a family that lives here or a family that's traveling through here.
Several hours north sits the town of Mountain View. It's sandwiched between Denver, Wheat Ridge, and a small town called Lakewood. Mountain View is only 6 blocks wide and 3 blocks deep, but it's home to a couple of major roadways. Tickets here in 2013 amounted to more than half the town's budget.
I don't look at it as revenue, to be perfectly honest with you.
That's Mountain View Mayor Jeff Kitty.
Do we slow people down? Yes, we do. And isn't that what traffic enforcement is all about?
Mountain View police don't write many tickets for speeding. They're more for things like failing to wear a seatbelt or tinted windows. About 300 tickets were for obstructed view, like having dice in the mirror. This last thing made headlines last year when a local TV station reported that Mountain View had more obstructed view citations than Denver, Boulder, and Aurora combined. Mayor Kitty says they're making changes, but...
We haven't done anything illegal, haven't done anything wrong. We're very careful about what tickets we write. and that our officers are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
I got pulled over for, they said that my TIM tag was expired, and it wasn't expired, so they wrote me a ticket for a defective tire.
That's Ashley Lucero. She's a 23-year-old single mother from the nearby town of Thornton. The police report states that the officer verified Lucero's tags were up to date, but then noticed a gash in her tire and wrote the $80 ticket. Lucero says she couldn't pay it all at once, so she went to court. After all the court fees and payment fines, Lucero ended up owing $230 total.
It's just money, money, money here.
The problem is we have the police basically being incentivized to kind of throw the Fourth Amendment out the window and stop people on the basis of a profit.
That's Ezekiel Edwards. He's the director of the ACLU's Criminal Law Reform Project.
As people look at this issue more closely, you're going to see this problem in many other places.
At least six states have some laws that cap revenue from fines, or at least require an audit if the town reaches or exceeds that cap. Democratic Congressman Emanuel Cleaver wants a 30% ticket cap nationwide.
If it goes to the floor, it's going to pass overwhelmingly.
The congressman announced his bill in March, but he says he's been unable to attract a Republican co-sponsor.
But I don't think it's the purview of the state or the federal government to determine those standards.
That's Sam Mamet. He lobbies for Colorado cities and towns on the state and national capitals. He believes that police enforcement of traffic laws should be left up to individual communities.
That's for the electorate and the voters in those communities to decide. And if it becomes a contentious or controversial issue, I can assure you the city council or the town board will hear about it.
Altogether, Colorado cities and towns collected more than $120 million in ticket revenue in 2013. For most towns, average revenues were close to 4% of their total budget. In Denver, I'm Katie Kuntz for Marketplace.
Economics and life are about decisions, what to do or not to do, and the options, good and bad, safe or risky, that we choose. Max Dower chose the path less conventional.
I was in my last year of law school, and I was supposed to take the bar exam. I was considering my prospects as an entertainment lawyer and looking at the amount of money I was going to make, which was going to be around $80,000 a year. And then I looked at the expenses that I was going to have, rent, car, medical, and then the big one, which is, you know, the student loan debt from law school. I wasn't going to be saving any money. And that just didn't add up to me. I decided to roll the dice, not take the bar exam, and launch this company that I thought had infinite potential. My name is Max Dower, and I am the founder of Unfortunate Portrait. I was in my third year of law school, and I'd been drawing as a hobby my whole life, really, and I started posting my drawings on Instagram. You know, they're fun drawings that made my friends laugh, and they were just little portraits of different people, famous, some not famous. The Instagram account slowly started gaining these followers, strangers from all over the world, and I decided to start putting my drawings on t-shirts. What really changed things was this drawing I did called The Tea Party, which has Mr. T, Ice-T, and Pusha-T. I posted that on Instagram, and I woke up the next day, and I had just thousands of new followers. I got money with the best of them. I realized that Pusha-T had reposted my drawing on Instagram. My account was just blowing up. Ballers, I put numbers on the boards. As demand grew and as I was getting more and more orders on the website, I had to keep up and be making the inventory to fill these orders. So I was using like three or four credit cards at once in order to pay for just one round of production. The buyer from Fred Siegel actually contacted me over Instagram. I thought it was fake. Fred Siegel wanted to order a bunch of shirts. Every week, there's like new exciting things that will present themselves, you know, opportunities, whether it's a collaboration or a new store account, a foreign distributor. I'm always kind of excited waking up because it's like, what cool thing could happen today?
Max Dower, he's the founder of Unfortunate Portrait. This final note on the way out today, just because we mentioned it a couple of times last week, that Indiegogo campaign to crowdfund the European bailout to the tune of 1.6 billion euros. Yeah, didn't quite get there. Topped out yesterday and closed with 1.9 million euros in the bank. 108,000 people contributed, which is kind of amazing and cool, too. No word, though, on whether any of them were named Angela Merkel. Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 93 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up 5 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 picked up 12 points. That is 0.6%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.